ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृतं नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरयेत्। नष्टप्रायेषु अवद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवती उत्तमा श्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी। I like the mother Nanda address, why we address Vasudevaya, not Krishnaya. I'm sure you all remember. So Mother Nanda says, because we attend this Bhagavatam class to purify our consciousness, and Vasudeva is the predominating deity of consciousness. So everything Prabhupada did is perfect. Of course, Vasudeva's name is also Krishna, spoken by Garga Acharya in Vrindavan, in the cow shed, secretly, while Nanda Maharaj was thinking his son was born one life in Vasudeva's house, something like that. He understands one thing because of his love for Krishna. So today is May 9th, Thursday. We are reciting Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 6, Text 26 to 29. And 26 also has a purport. 29 has the biggest purport. So we'll go to the 29th. So 26, we'll recite the verses and then we'll focus on 29. Please join. Sarpa charu agni vidad bhoya scooter scooter trip. Thank you. Again. Sarpa charu agni vidad bhoya scooter trip bada adivirnipa panchatvam richate jantur bhunta ardhava karmata. Translation, when a conditioned soul is killed by snakes, thieves, fire, lightning, hunger, disease, or anything else, he is experiencing the reaction of to his own past work. Purport, according to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, King Parikshit obviously was not suffering the reaction of past karma. This sentence is very important. As a great devotee, he was perpetually brought. As a great devotee, he was perpetually brought back home. This is an edited version. Okay, we'll read that. As a great devotee, he was personally brought back. Oh, I see. Brought back home, back to Godhead, by the Lord. 27. Tasmat satram idam rajan sanstay bhavi charikam sarpa anagaso dagda janir distam hi bhuyate. Translation. Therefore, my dear king, please stop this sacrificial performance which was initiated with the intent of doing harm to others. Many innocent snakes have already been burned to death. Indeed, all persons must suffer the unforeseen consequences of their past activities. Purport. Brihaspati here admits that although the snakes appeared to be innocent by the Lord's arrangement, they were also being punished for previous vicious activities. You remember, they disobeyed the order of their guru, mother, Kodru. Text 28. Suta uvacha Iti ukta sa tahettiyaha maharshir manayan bachaha sarpa satradupārataha ujjayam asobhagpatim. Translation. Suta Goswami continued, advised in this manner, Maharaj Janmanjaya replied, so be it. Honoring the words of the great sage, he desired from performing the snake sacrifice. He desisted from performing the snake sacrifice and worship Brihaspati, the most eloquent of sages. Now, 29. The word-to-word meaning first. So while we are reciting, we can be aware. Sa esa, this very Vishnu of the Supreme Lord, Vishnu. Mahamaya, the illusory material energy. Avadhyaya, by her who cannot be checked. Alakshana, indiscernible. Jaya, by whom Muhyanti, being bewildered. Asya, of the Lord. Eva, indeed. Atma Bhutaha, the part and parcel spirit souls. Bhuteshu, within their material bodies, guna of the modes of nature, vrittivihi, by the functions. Shaisha Vishnur Mahamaya. Actually should be abuddha. Abaddhaya alakshana jaya. Mohayanti ashaiva atma bhuta. Bhuteshu guna vritti vihi. Shaisha Vishnur Mahamaya. Abhadhaya Alakshana Jaya. Mohayanti Ashaiva Atma Bhutaha. Bhuteshu Guna Vritti Vihi. Shaisha Vishnur Mahamaya. Abhadhaya Alakshana Jaya. Mohayanti Ashaiva Atma Bhuta. Bhuteshu Guna Vritti Vihi. Please chant. Shaisha Vishnur Mahamaya. Alaksha Alakshana Jaya. Mohayantya Atma Bhuta. Bhuteshu Guna Vritti Vihi. Shaisha Vishnur Mahamaya. Abhadda Lakshana Jaya. Mohayanti Asya Vatma Bhuta. Bhuteshu Guna Vritti Vihi. Shaisha Vishnur Mahamaya. Maya Lakshana Jaya. Mohayanti Ashaiva Atma Bhuta. Bhuteshu Guna Vritti Vihi. Shaisha Vishnur Mahamaya. Vadaya Lakshana Jaya. Mahatma Sachatma Bhuta Bhuteshu Guna Vritti Bihi Saisha Vishnu Mahamaya Avadhyaya Lakshanajaya Muhayanti Atma Bhuta Bhuteshu Guna Vritti Vihi Saisha Vishnu Mahamaya Abhadaya Lakshanajaya Mahayanti Ashaiva Atma Bhuta Bhuteshu Guna Vritti Vihi. Translation and purport by the sincere followers of Srila Prabhupada. This is indeed the Supreme Lord Vishnu's illusory energy, which is unstoppable and difficult to perceive, although the individual spirit souls are part and parcel of the Lord. Through the influence of this illusory energy, they are bewildered by their identification with various material bodies. The purport, the illusory energy of Lord Vishnu is so powerful that even the illustrious son of King Parikshit was temporarily misdirected because he was a devotee of Lord Krishna. However, his bewilderment was quickly rectified. On the other hand, an ordinary materialistic person without the special protection of the Lord plummeted to the depths of material ignorance. Factually, materialistic persons are not interested in the protection of Lord Vishnu. Therefore, their complete ruination is inevitable. Srila Prabhupada ki Vande aham Sri Guru Sri Juta Pada Kamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanitam Tam Sajivam Sadaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakhanitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunnavadi Pashyata Deshatari Bancha Kalpa Taruvescha Kripa Sindhu Vaivacha Patitanam Pavanebho Vaishnavebho Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. This chapter gives us a few questions. that Parikshit Maharaj has had a 7 days to leave. Is this enough time to accomplish what his purpose of life was? Because he asked that question, what one person should do who is about to die. And this is ending of Bhagavatam, and Srila Sukhdev Goswami summarized, yes, it is more than enough. So I ask a question to you all too. A lot of you are very senior to me. That what one thing we can do today that it will improve my spiritual life? Tangible, something remarkable. Parikshit Maharaj thought of turning to Krishna and hearing about Krishna is the one thing he could do that gave him ultimate satisfaction, ultimate achievement. And adored, appreciated by entire audience, including his grandfather, father, great-grandfather, they are all there. Just imagine you giving class and Prabhupada is there, Bhakti Siddhanta Thakur is there, Gaur Krishnadas Babaji is there, Bhakti Vinod Thakur is there, and you are speaking. This is what happened to Sukhdev Goswami. Vyasdeva was there, Narad Muni was there, Parashar Muni was there. They're all great personalities, the Guru Parampara. What was the biggest significance in this? That Narad Muni, even other, they had a assumption that Bhagavatam is not for everybody. It's for the Paramahansas. And there is verses also backing this, that is true. But when Sukhdev Goswami spoke, even Narad Muni, Vyasdeva, was surprised. The way he delivered, internal, the mentality he had, the intention he had, his inner connection with the Supreme Brahman and his deliverance was very unique. When Srila Prabhupada finished the 13th chapter, if you look at the last verse, is if it says that Sukhdev Goswami was so much into inner world sometime, that Janmanjaya, whom we are discussing, was such a great devotee, that he used to have a Sankirtan party in that Sukartala. Sukartala is a place where Sukhdev Goswami spoke. That he had a big kirtan, that to bring Sukhdev Goswami back to the place where Parikshit Maharaj is about to leave in few days. So he would have a kirtan to bring him. He has tremendous big respect to his father. And he knew his father's position also. So from many angles to look at it, I'm going to focus this verse today. That first verse it says, there are 8 ways death can come to someone. You can be beaten by snake. I got snake bite when I was 9.5 years old. I didn't die, I'm still here. The thieves. And you remember the story of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that he saw his guard. Bhaktivinoda Thakur come from a very, very, very wealthy family. Today, modern Calcutta is nothing but, majority Calcutta is nothing but Bhaktivinoda Thakur's family given as a gift to the city, municipality. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, one time when he was a little boy, he saw his guard in the house chanting always Ram's name. He said, why are you chanting so much about Ram's name always? Then he told that one day, before he became a guard, he was a thief. You may think like maybe not all thieves kills, but even at that time, so when one day he saw a house, this thief, he thought he's going to rob. When he entered there, some other he could not find. He got so angry that he started cutting everybody lived there. And after he came out, he got frustrated, and little some other moonlight came, and then he realized that was his guru's house. He killed his own guru and guru's family. Then he went to a sage who told him, keep on chanting Ram's name all the time. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur grew up like this, experiencing from his own life how they causes death. The fire causes death, we know, in California every year, some or other, more or less every year. Vidyut bhaya, or lightning, that also kills. Skuta, from hunger. Trit, thirst. Vyadi, disease. Adivi, and other agent, means 8+. Many other reason could be.
School shooting,
thank you. How it applies to us? I remember Sesha Prabhu, when he gave class, was very catchy thing to me. It was like he says, why all these four types of destruction, pralaya? Not four, but the three. What was the main purpose? Why so elaborately explanation given? And I'm summarizing what I heard from him. Sesha Prabhu says, to prove that we do not have shelter of all those things that destroy. Our main shelter is Krishna. So for us to turn to Krishna, this description elaborately given was very nice. Here in chapter 8 Bhagavad Gita, the entire chapter is focused, every chapter has a focus point. Entire chapter of 8th chapter Bhagavad Gita is focused on how to depart from this world. And those famous verses, antakalecha mameva smaran mukta kalevaram ja prayati samad bhavam jati nastata samsay. At the moment of death, what type of consciousness we have to have by which we can remember Krishna at death moment, that we will attain him in the spiritual world? You have to have a 6 prerequisite. This is what the whole chapter is. If you can understand these 6 things before you die, you will come to a state of consciousness that will attract Krishna, and you will remember him to attain him. So first thing, the Arjuna asked question to Krishna, and if you read, Prabhupada gave a vast purport, the entire 8th chapter. First one is, what is Brahman? Can somebody tell me, what is Brahman, the word Brahman?
Spirit.
Spirit, good. Something more?
Effulgence.
Something more? You read 8th chapter, come on.
7 definitions. 4.
No, so many definitions is we are escaping from the subject matter. 4 things, very important. Oho bhagyam, oho bhagyam, nanda gopa brajastinam, jad mitrani paramananda, purna brahma sanatana. Sri Krishna is the original complete Brahman who plays in the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj. And Prabhupada brag about this story of another person. He said, what is the use of studying all this philosophy? The purna brahma is in the Nanda Maharaj's house. Prabhupada goes like this. He says, so he went there. He said, no need to study anymore. Just go there to Nanda Maharaj's backyard where Krishna is playing. He's the purna brahma. First thing we have to focus is purna brahma Krishna. That verse he says, Brahmaji himself says this, purna brahma sanatana. Then second, from that purna brahma, he desired, divine desire. When his divine desire comes, the shakti, impersonal potency. This Mukti Devi, everything is a person in spiritual concept. She emanates the Brahma Jyoti from his body. unlimitedly. This is second Brahman, Nirvishesh Brahman. Then the third Brahman, when Krishna's sweet will, Prabhupada writes in second canto, wants to create a material atmosphere, then Mahat Brahma is born from there, covered by the Pradhan, three modes. Within the Mahat Brahma, those who have misused the free will enter in, Jiva Brahma entered there. So this fourth Brahman has to be understood before you die. In order to fix your consciousness in Krishna to attain Him, to go back home. Second, Arjuna asks, Adhatma, who am I? Who am I? I am Brahmasmi. That's good. First thing is very good. More, little more? Servant of Krishna. Very good. This thing should be there fundamentally. Third, what is karma kanda? Little bit. What is karma, first of all? No. We are also doing, Prabhupada was doing activity. Was he doing karma? So karma is not activity alone. Yes, karma activity is for the karmi understanding.
Huh?
Yes, related to body, very good. So long I have a desire to enjoy separately from Krishna, it is karma, period. Doesn't matter what it is. It is the consciousness behind the activity is more important than activity itself. Karma means I earn the money, I want to enjoy. Devotion is not an absence of action. It is an absence of selfishness, self-centeredness. It is the absence of the self-centeredness. We have to become selfless. Fourth, Adibhuta. And when you look at the Bhagavad Gita today, you will see all this. Wow, all the six are there. Only for one purpose, to come to state of consciousness, to remember Krishna, to attain Him, and enter into His abode. Number four, Adibhuta. What are the prakriti, material nature? First glance of the prakriti is, what is prakriti? It's the shadow of Swarup Shakti. Krishna's own potency, but it is shadow. Krishna never associate with prakriti, material nature. Chayeva jasya bhuvanani vibhurti durga. Yes. And prakriti does not have, just like in the surrendering process, Mahaprabhu told that mayadhisa mayabasa ishwar jive bhed. If you consider Mayadevi as like a big, deadly, dangerous dog, and you as a Alachua devotee want to enter into Krishna's palace, but outside the gate there's a big, dangerous dog going to kill you. But if you have a relationship with the Lord, who's the master of the palace, and master finds out that you are at the door, he tells the dog, quiet, this is my friend. Then what will happen? You can enter. So two things we must remember. Srila Prabhupada said that Krishna is controller of Maya, he is also stronger than Maya. In order to make our surrender successful, the Krishna can tell the dog, stop. This is my friend, let him come. He has a right to come to my house, he's my friend. Then no more fear. So like this, we must remember this Adibhuta.
What's that verse?
Maya Basho, Maya Disha, Ishwar Jive Bhed. It's in Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Ishwar Jive
Bhed. The difference between living entity and the Lord is that one is under, and one is never under, over. Maya Basha means under. Maya Adhisha means the Lord. Mahaprabhu explained. Then Adi Jagna. Adi Jagna. What is the purpose of our activities? Little more.
Please Krishna
first. Then purification automatically comes. But if we miss the main point, just for purification I'm chanting, it is not a good way. When I do kirtan, I'm offering to myself, my chanting, I'm under guidance of Prabhupada, my spiritual master, I'm offering to Krishna. I was disrespecting, avoiding his service for many lives. Please, my Lord, please accept my offerings. Please accept me. Your servant you have sent, your intimate associate to take me. I am under his guidance trying to offer you. Please accept me. Please accept me. This offering attitude has to be there in every service we do. Then Krishna will see. Because on our own endeavor, we cannot force divine grace to descend in my heart, or we cannot be proud to think like on my own endeavor I'm chanting 64 rounds, I can replace the divine grace. Not possible. Impossible. So then why we endeavor? We endeavor following his order, to draw his attention. Then when he sees, Prabhupada sees that I'm trying my best, then from his heart, two potencies comes to our heart. I found this in my tour in Florida. I was away for 2 weeks. These two potencies, Prabhupada asked that question, that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu delivered thousands of people. Now, Acharyas are traveling, I don't know who was traveling that time beside Prabhupada, but Prabhupada himself is asking that question, delivering thousands of people. What does that mean? He asked that question. And then he answered. Prabhupada is so kind. It's in chapter Madhya Lila chapter 7, 99. You can read the purport, beautiful. Then Prabhupada says, when a pure devotee delivering a conditioned soul means he invests these two potency, cognition potency and pleasure potency. Where are those potency? In the instruction when we follow. It is not going to come unless somebody follows. Cognition potency means we have an eternal relationship, but that's not enough. Because Duryodhan had a relationship with Krishna. Shishupal had a relationship. Kamsa had a relationship with Krishna. But they were deprived of love of God. Relationship, it has to be favorable attitude for the pleasure of Krishna. So love has to be there together. Very nicely, Madhya Lila chapter 6, 160, also Prabhupada talks of the same thing. He breaks down that nobody can escape from it until these two potency comes. It is necessary. We should focus. And the last one is Adi Daiva. Vishwaru Adi Daiva. Who is the object of our sacrifice? Right now you are sacrificing, you are giving your oral reception, you are forcing yourself to sit here, you are forcing yourself to discuss about Krishna. So you are sacrificing. And so when you are sacrificing, but who is supposed to be the beneficiary of this?
Krishna.
Who said that? Can you explain how? It's true, what do you say? Maybe I can give you little tips. In Madhurya Kadambini, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says, the moment a soul comes in contact with Krishna consciousness, Krishna in Golok Vrindavan jumped. Whatever he's doing, he is happy, dancing. Yes, that soul is coming back. That soul is coming back. He's happy. He's so happy. Then I heard one time Mother Urmila says, when that soul tried to turn back towards Maya, Krishna is very sad. Every endeavor we do to come back to our spiritual abode to Krishna, to serve Him, eternally engaged, it makes Krishna happy. When we chant, Mahaprabhu says, Kirtaniya Sadahari, we follow Mahaprabhu. He becomes happy. How are you chanting? It pleases them. So these are the six way we can prepare before we leave this world. This purport, last purport, illustrates so much about the moha, illusion. Because of the time, but I'm going to give in a 5 minutes. The word moha could be illusion, could be bewilderment, could be due to ignorance, so many way Prabhupada translate. All the moha, you can put it into three category, or I put it into three category. One is due to the ignorance, influenced by the three modes of material nature. And Krishna Himself spoke Trivir gunair mayir bhava sarvam idam jagat mohayam navi jananti mameva paramo bhayam. The entire whole creation is under the three modes, bewildering them. So those verses are, Krishna is speaking, that out of ignorance, people are actually bewildered due to ignorance, avidya. And you know that example of everywhere, in Gainesville, Alachua, beside the devotees, they are always bewildered. What's the biggest? The four types are the most bewilderment for the conditioned soul. What are those? First is, anatmana ke atman. What is not self, identify himself as a self. What is that? The body. Why Prabhupada found this? Because it is actually deadly, considering self as a body. The four illusions are the biggest. The one is that the identity of the soul by the body is the worst. The second, what is eternal happiness? And what is material happiness? We, or those who identify body as the self, takes this bodily pleasure is the ultimate pleasure. It's the worst thing soul is doing. What is real knowledge of the Supreme Lord Krishna versus what the knowledge of this world, Nobel Prize winner or something, PhD or something big. I'm not against any PhD one or something. It's just that they think this knowledge about this is everything. You have to be educated how to discipline your mind. You have to be educated to restrict, discipline your relationship with the family, with this. Those are all good, not bad. But if Krishna is not added, what is the purpose of all this? The first bewilderment comes, am I the maker of my destiny or life is predestined? Anybody knows the answer? Are you the maker of your destiny or life is predestined? We're the maker. Huh? Little more. Actually, it's both. It is both. This was the question of Dhritarashtra, the first sloka of Bhagavad Gita. Because generally we think, certain things in your life you can see, it is destined. Gray hair. What can I do about it? It's done. Death will come, it's done. Tomorrow's talk and today's talk is the same thing. Janmanjaya, abstain, return from this. No need to do any more killing snake. Because three reasons is given. One reason was given, it was not a good intention to do this jagna, first of all. Why? It was hate. He hated the takshaka and he was grieving for his father's death. With this intention, it's not a good thing to do anything. So that was one. Then Suta Goswami says the second point was that Brihaspati confirming that even though nothing moves without the sanction of God, so all the snake died because they have done something bad before. And we all know that big pastimes. It takes one hour, 2 hours, the pastimes of the Kodrus and Vinatas, beautiful pastime. That where he committed offense, disrespecting, disobeying, so as a result they're supposed to be dead and they're dead. So okay, now it's finished, let's stop now. He's giving a good reason, very good reason why he should stop. And the third one was, hey, ultimate purpose of his father, achieving the goal of life he already obtained. What the need of any more disturbance? So then, second category of the illusion by the practitioner like us. And King Parikshit, Janmanjaya is actually proving this point to us. Many times, even Ramanujacharya was glorifying his disciple, Govinda, very nicely. Such a nice, very sincere devotee. So one day, and the godbrother was trying to watch it. How he is serving so nicely. He makes his Guru Maharaj's very nice bed. And then he lies on it and feel, oh, very good, I like it. This is not a Guru Seva, service to Guru. What kind of, he's making the bed and now he's lying and saying it is good. So then another day he saw near the actually temple, in that temple is still there, there was a prostitute house. And he was listening something at the door of the prostitute. He said, what kind of, Gurudev said he is one of the best sincere devotee, but he's listening prostitute discussion. This is horrible. How can he be? So he had a doubt and he was disturbed. So he asked Ramanujacharya, can you please purify my heart, please? Why you disciple? My godbrother is doing like this and I'm not understanding how a great personality do like this. What did he do? He said he was hearing the prostitute conversation. So call him. Complaint came that you are hearing prostitute. Yes, Gurudev, I never heard that pastime of Krishna. It was so beautiful. That I was like, I had tears almost. I was thinking like, I was aware that she is prostitute, but I was not aware that another Brahmano was associating with her. During that time, he told the story and I heard from far and I came nearby. What was that about Krishna? They talk. So when I heard it, Gurudev, I was like overwhelmed. I'm still thinking Krishna is so beautiful. Another complaint that you make my bed and you lie down on top. Of course, Gurudev, because I want to make sure if it is comfortable or not. If it is not comfortable, then I have to remake again. It reminded me, Prabhupada was sitting on a couch. You probably heard that story. And there was a needle. So Prabhupada said to Govinda Dasi, did you want to kill your guru? She said, what did I do? He said, there's a needle on the couch. You told me to sit. Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, those days he was not Prabhupada, he was Swamiji. Prabhupada came after. So he said, I'm so sorry, I had no clue. I'm so sorry, it was not intention. So of course it was not intention. But it was relating that why Govinda does this? Just to make sure that his Guru Maharaj will have a good bedding. When the Ranganathji temples, I remember one beautiful story that Gaura Keshava Prabhu told, that there was a girl whose father used to bring flower to make a garland. And this girl told his father, let me make the garland. But this is for the Lord, you have to be very careful. Yes, yes, I'll wash my hand. And she would make the garland, then she would put it on her neck. And it would go, those days there was no mirror, she would go near the well and look at, how do I look? Very good. Then she would come back to the room and say, Father, here, take the garland for the Lord. So the pujari, it's going on for months. One day pujari looking, there is a long hair. He said, where the long hair comes in the garland you offer to the Lord? So he immediately didn't offer, he called. And the Brahmana, he confessed, he said, this is not proper. You don't have a hair, you have a short hair and little sika, but you have a long hair. Something is wrong. You must have given, somebody must be involved in this. And he was scared. Something wrong. His daughter did it, but he didn't know what to say. But he just told him that, I'm sorry, my daughter used to do. Why? Why? But how the hair came here? Oh, I don't know, I'll ask her. So he asked her. So she said, well, I always check how it looks, whether it will look good on the Lord or not. Otherwise, I rearrange. So this is not good. This is offense. It is not offerable. So he didn't offer. So without the garland, the Lord had that day. And he took prasadam and went in a, taking nap in the dream. First time in his life, Lord came in his dream. He said, I am not happy with your worship. He said, my Lord, what did I do? He said, I have no garland. Then he's conversing with the Lord. Well, this girl did, said, I want to marry this girl. She has so much love, you cannot imagine. I only accept your offering because of that garland, because that girl has so much love. So make a big arrangement for my wedding. From that day, the pujari woke up and he immediately went to that house and confronted and then put on that garland. And that night the Lord said how he should arrange the big feast, go tell the king how to arrange a big procession, and she will come in my altar, she will marry me, and she will remain my wife. From those days, most of the girls in that village, still today, they always think, maybe the Lord will marry me. They always make garland. So like that, bewilderment also come to the sadhaka that we discuss. And the bewilderment comes, bewilderment eternally exists, but not a product of Maya, by product of Jogamaya, in spiritual world. In Sudharma Hall, there's thousands of examples. In Sudharma Hall, Krishna has thousands of groups exhibiting their expertism to make the Lord happy. So one Brahmana with other thousand Brahmana, they are reciting the verses. And he's crying. And his son said, Baba, why are you crying? You're reading the Shastra for the Lord, but why are you crying? He said, I'm crying because the Lord is so happy. And hearing this, and I want to look at him more than I'm reading it. But I feel guilty because I'm supposed to read. When you read the Shastra, you're supposed to do your job, service. But Lord's beauty is so overwhelming, so I want to do both, but I cannot. So it's like I'm emotionally crying. He said, can I cry? He said, no, not right now. When you grow up, then you'll learn. But Baba, I'm already feeling emotional. I want to cry. He said, no, son, don't do this. Then eventually, after a little while, he fell in love with his own son, because his son, growing with crying for Krishna, and they embrace each other. And Sanatana Goswami Pad writes, the son is not a son, it's Krishna also. So this Krishna also loving another Krishna in the assembly. This is going on every day, but they don't know. In Vrindavan, there is a problem with everybody in this world with this bewilderment. But this is giving happiness, relishment. Even the Brahmanas, Prabhupada writes in Nectar of Devotion, you can read. The Brahmanas, thinking the beauty of Krishna, they read the scriptures. But then Nanda Maharaj's son passed by and they think, God did not come in Vaishya family, they know that. God comes only in a Kshatriya family and Brahmana family. So Nanda Maharaj's son is not God, they know that. But his beauty is stealing their heart and they cannot focus on their duty, service. So they go to a court of Nanda Maharaj. In the court, Nanda Maharaj sits there and he hears the both sides. And he said, of course it is not possible, you know my son is not God, so don't worry about it. Because in the middle of the night when there is a thunder, I hear the knock on the door. Why? Krishna says, I'm so scared. Can I sleep with you on the bed? He gives up his bed and he sleeps with here. So this bewilderment is everywhere. Mother Yashoda and Krishna conversing. Just this will be my last. That Krishna is asking Mother Yashoda, where all this creation comes from, Mother? Say, from God. Who maintains everything? God. Where do I come from, Mother? From me. And then he says, who is going to maintain me? Me. As for everybody came from God, but as for you, Krishna, only from me you came. This is bewilderment, you may think. But this bewilderment is nourishing. So you want, if we focus on that bewilderment, this bewilderment will disappear. That was the conclusion. Gaur Premanande Hari. I have 1 minute. If anybody has a comment, question, reflection, correction. Everybody is convinced you want to get bewildered in the spiritual world? Wonderful. Gaur Premanande Hari Hari Bol, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram.
And, you know, so even when we are wrong, we still try to prove we are right. You know? So this is, you know, one aspect of Vaishnava etiquette, that actually a devotee should never defend him or herself. We should defend others, but we should not defend ourselves. And this is hardly even understood, right? Nobody talks about it much. So, and in fact, we can almost say we do the opposite. We defend ourselves, but if we see another devotee in trouble, we don't stick up our head and we say something and defend that other person, you know? We think, oh no, it's not my business and I don't want to damage my relationships and why should I say something, you know? So we actually do the opposite of what we do should be doing. We defend ourselves, we're really good at that, but and we don't defend others. But it should be the other way around. We should defend others, but not ourselves. Right? And very natural, if everybody would follow that etiquette, then even if we are treated unfairly or whatever, surely somebody would be there to defend us. Right? If everybody follows the etiquette that we should defend others and not ourselves, it wouldn't be a problem. Right? We wouldn't have to worry to defend ourselves. Yeah, so this is a pretty important thing, which we almost do every day. Every day. Yes. Every day Krishna gives us some opportunities, you know, to let go of our ego, dissolve it, but we always jump for the bait and we do the opposite and we defend and we answer back and but. You know, all these sentences starting with, but it wasn't me, and but actually it was like this and this and this. So these are all these patterns we are completely trapped in, you know? And we constantly defend. And especially towards seniors, this is considered to be so uncultured and gross and, yeah. I mean, especially towards Guru, my God, you know. I mean, I have heard stories, here are so many Prabhupada disciples, you would know all better than me, but what I've heard, that Prabhupada used to get very angry when devotees were defending themselves. When Prabhupada used to say something, and then devotees say, yes, but Prabhupada, but. And they think, oh, maybe he doesn't know or he didn't understand or something. And Prabhupada used to get very strong about it, you know? Because towards Guru, so inappropriate. Even if Guru, let's imagine Guru unfairly chastises his disciple, still the disciple should never defend, He should have that attitude. Well, all right, maybe so many other times I got away with it without chastisement. So now, you know, I'm getting what I actually deserved already before. And actually, I deserve so much more than this, but Krishna only gives me one drop of what I really deserve. So even if Guru treats us unfairly, you know, disciples should never defend. Because, I mean, Guru is, you know, intelligent enough to, you know, he can get the information from somewhere else, what actually happened, even if he doesn't know the full picture or something. And also, again, if other devotees see a person is wrongly chastised, then it's up to other people to go up to Guru and say, oh, actually, excuse me, Maharaj, it was actually like this and this or something. But the disciple himself should never defend. He should simply embrace that opportunity to let go of the ego. Because this is one of the ego's demands, that the ego wants justice and fairness and, you know? So, and just to let go of that demand the ego makes, it's a very healthy and purifying exercise. Just to accept it and say, okay, no problem, let me accept. You know, I so many times I did not receive chastisement. So now this is Guru's blessing and mercy. I'm getting that kind of mercy of chastisement. And not only towards Guru, but actually towards, you know, especially any senior person, actually. You know, yes. So, I mean, this is something which is really not understood, you know. I remember once I was giving the seminar, I can't remember where, and immediately after the seminar I was speaking to some young devotee, some bhakta, and I can't remember what the issue was, but he was immediately defending, but, immediately after the session. And I said to him, Prabhu, remember we just talked about it, don't defend. He couldn't even hear it. He was what, and going on and on and on. So that's how, you know, how we are trapped in these ego patterns of behaviors. And even hearing it, later on I will present six steps, very practical six steps of internal work, how we can let go. Because even just hearing it, we shouldn't defend. You will see, it's not so easy to stop it. Because the ego is so strong and we've been acting like that for so long, so many years, maybe so many lifetimes. It's not a question of just making the resolution, okay, I'm not going to defend anymore. It would be great if it was that easy. But no, the ego is pushing and demanding, and it's also subtle. And before we even realize, we did it again. You know? Yeah, it's a whole thing. And I mean, of course, I know this is Alachua and this is America. But yeah, I feel I should say this anyway, because Prabhupada says it in the Bhagavatam, that this is also there in regards to husband and wife. That actually, in Krishna's culture and system, the wife should also not answer back to the husband. This is this highly purifying journey what married life is all about. That, you know, the wife, she's practicing on the husband to give up the false ego by seeing him as superior. There is one strong purport, I didn't bring it with me because it's in another course, but where Prabhupada says, by his constitutional position, the husband wants to be in the superior position. And by her constitutional position, the wife is in a subordinate position. And Prabhupada says, this has to be accepted by the wife, even if there is some wrong on the husband's side, behalf, even if there's some wrong in him. Prabhupada cited, wife has to tolerate, and then there will be peace. That purport is there. It's all in the Bhagavatam, you know? And of course, yeah, America, we don't like to hear these things, you know, because we think, no, and in modern days, there's complete equality there, and. But if we want our married life to be a purifying journey, you know, then we have to accept these things, you know? And we women are the winner. Because we are winning double, actually. First of all, we're winning because we will have a harmonious relationship with the husband, and not only a husband, with men around us. And that's one thing. And the other way we are winning is by giving up the false ego, dissolving it. Let him be right, even if he's wrong. Sooner or later he will notice. It's not up to us. We don't have to tell him. So, and even to parents also, it took me a long time to realize this. Why I had a bit of tension sometimes with my mother, even though we have a great relationship and she's so favorable and everything. But sometimes our relationship was a little tense. And it took me so long to realize how I was contributing to this tension. Because parents are in a superior position. You know, and I was thinking, because I'm a devotee and I'm a preacher, that I have to tell her and I have to answer back and correct her and boo, she was so sensitive about it, and she just didn't like it, and she was boo, she was reacting, you know? And now, yeah, I mean, it's not even that long ago after giving this, seminar for a while. Then I realized, yes, parents also, they are in a superior position. And it upsets the natural balance and chemistry of a relationship if the person in a subordinate position doesn't follow that etiquette. You know? And now I'm consciously using, you know, my relationship with my mother to really dissolve my ego and not, you know, counteract and answer back and make sure, you know, I establish my superiority here by knowing it better. I let go of it. I leave it. I let it go by and let her be right and, you know, like that. And yeah, our relationship is so much smoother, you know. Yeah, definitely. And I get the benefit of practicing on her, you know. How to take the humble position, even if she's wrong, even if she talks nonsense, doesn't matter, let her be right. You know, she's the mother, you know, she's superior. So, I mean, even this with the parents, it's not so commonly understood. So many devotees are struggling with their parents, you know, with the relationships. And there is one big reason. I mean, I've experienced it in my own relationship with my mother, you know, and I realized how much I contribute to the tension by not following that etiquette, you know, that superiors, we are not meant to answer back. And I mean, you know, like in India, in the older generation ladies in India, they learn this from small age on, you know, ladies teach that. I mean, you probably remember from your mother or something, you know. They learned that from their mothers, how to let the husband be right, even if he's wrong, and how, when to shut up and better be quiet and not having the last word, you know, isn't it? Yes, but this is all completely unknown these days, completely unknown, you know. Yes, yes. Yeah, so it's a whole thing, and it's, you know, and yeah, so in any case, let's go back to this point of, you know, we are meant to, let go of the ego. We let it go by. We dissolve it. But what we do instead is always protecting and defending. And one main mechanism of protecting and defending the ego is to blame others. You know? That we put always the blame on others, on other persons, or on external circumstances. It's such a classic way, you know, of protecting and defending the ego. Oh, it's not me, it's the other person, and actually it's her fault, or it's his fault, and actually it's because of that and that circumstances. And we find excuses why, you know, we can't be like this and that and whatever. So finding excuses and blaming others. Oh my God, I mean, we do it all the time. We do it all the time, you know? And that's the mechanism there, because the ego wants to be right. And then, you know, it's interesting to understand how the false ego affects the intelligence. So false ego affects the intelligence, and then the intelligence always finds so many justifications why I am right and everybody else is wrong. So that's how false ego affects the intelligence. And sometimes to such an extent that the intelligence really distorts everything just to satisfy the ego's demands of being right. You may have had such situations, I'm sure, because it's interesting to understand that there is no objective experience. Everybody experiences the same situation completely differently according to their own mindset, their own consciousness. Everybody has a different experience. Even a different hearing experience. Even everybody here sitting in the room, everybody hears something different. There's no objective experience. I mean, how many times have I had this? That people in the question and answer session, they ask, oh, Mataji, you said, da, 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 da. And I, huh? I said that? No, sorry, I didn't even talk about it. I didn't even use the terms, the topic, you know? And you think, my God, what are people hearing here, you know? Yeah, so this is what it's like. Everybody experiences, hears something completely different according to their own consciousness, mindset. So, and I've had situations where you're completely puzzled. And you think, how is it possible that another person experiences the same situation so differently? You know, completely differently. It's almost, you know, like the intelligence just distorts the whole situation just so to justify that I am right, everybody else is wrong. Have you ever had such an experience? Where a person really, where you think, how is it possible, you know, that, and you wonder, is the person actually lying and making it up or something? Well, maybe that also, we don't know. But very often it is just the false ego affecting the intelligence to such a degree that the whole vision gets so clouded and the memory gets, you know, completely changed, how you remember a certain situation, something completely different comes out, completely distorted. So that's how the false ego affects the intelligence to such degree, you know, that the intelligence can always justify and protect the ego and defend, and yes, I'm right, everybody else is wrong. Yes. So it's quite mind-blowing, you know? How, it's quite mind-blowing how these things go on, you know? I mean, we often have it in some conflict situation or something, you know, and then a mediator comes and tries to mediate. And sometimes you have two sides, you know, experiencing the same situation completely differently. Huh? Yes, and that's how the ego gets in there. And I mean, we can say, because the false ego is so powerful and affecting our vision, that's exactly why we do need a mentor. Without this trusting, sheltering relationship, you know, where we have this well-wishing friend who is senior, who is more experienced, and who has no other interest except helping me in my spiritual growth and development. Without such a trusting relationship, we almost have no chance to even detect these things, you know? Because the ego can always find its ways how to, you know, defend and how to give us this idea that we are all right and we are fine and we are okay. And it's everybody else's fault and the situation's fault. So without a mentor, you know, where we have really this trusting relationship, you know, who can tap us on the shoulder and say, hey, you know, just let go of it. You know, you're just too much here on an ego trip or whatever, you know. So without such a trusting relationship, very hard to even see ourselves. I mean, I'm discussing the whole topic so, rather in all details about this mentorship thing, you know. But it's really like that. As long as we have material attachments and material desires, we cannot objectively assess ourselves. We can actually not see, you know, whether our practice is balanced and you know, we cannot see. And then very easily, you know, we cut corners and it starts in a very subtle way, but then, whoops, over the years or whatever, we are somewhere completely else. And if there's nobody there who's got that trusting relationship with us, then nobody can even help us and get us back on track. You know, because if there's such a trusting relationship is not developed before we get off track, then, oh, well, then again, the ego, oh, you were you to tell me, and blah, you know, so again, there's that defense mechanism there. And then nobody can actually save us from going off the cliff. Yeah. So unless we have that help of a confidential, well-wishing friend, you know, where we can really open our heart and share our innermost struggles and fears and challenges, you know, and we get some good advice, and we know that person has no other interest except, you know, helping us along. Without that, very difficult to deal with these ego things, you know, because instead of taking shelter of a well-wishing friend, we will take shelter of the false ego. That's what happens, you know, and that's why we often lose devotees. I mean, I have a section there also, maybe tomorrow we'll get to it, this being offended. Being offended. This is also a whole thing of the ego, you know? But we'll keep it for tomorrow. I hope you will come tomorrow to Ekadashi Vrata Mataji's place, so we will have the last session there tomorrow. Yeah, so, you know, so often it happens that there's some misunderstanding, some little conflict, you know, and then person gets offended, meaning it's taking shelter of the false ego, and then walking out, never to be seen again. Happens all the time, you know. So without these trusting, sheltering relationships, we cannot really make that much progress, you know, only to a certain level type thing, you know. Yes, and I mean, interesting, you know, the ego, the contaminating effects of the ego is so strong that it really bounces back and forwards like a ping pong ball. You know, like, let's imagine somebody comes up to us in some ego mood there, blah, getting on our case. So then immediately our ego is ignited and we are shooting back, you know, and like that it goes back and forwards, back and forwards. That's how the classical arguments are starting, right? And we are locked up in this ego battle, who is right and who is wrong. Yes, it has such a contaminating effect. And these things are also massively going on over internet. These debates, you know, over internet, where people actually don't want to find out the truth and hear from each other, but they just want to prove their position, that they're right. And no matter what you say, you know, they twist things around, make it into a weapon, throw it back at you, and then you think, oh, well, so many people are reading this here, it might be some public forum or Facebook or whatever it may be, and then you think, oh, well, I have to say something about it. If I'm quiet, then everybody thinks, oh, well, it must have been like this, you know, so we think, oh, well, we have to answer somehow to this. We can't just leave it at that. And then we answer something and then boom, comes the next attack, you know, and like this, it goes on and on and on, never ending, no end to it. And you can feel the contamination because, you know, in your heart, you get this ugly, agitated feeling of anger and boo, you know, and then in the mind and continues, you know, whenever some conversations or some situation goes on and on in our mind, right? We sometimes have this, that things go on in the mind. Or is it only me who has this sometimes? No? We do have this, yeah? Yes? So this is always a sign of the false ego. You know, hanging on to it, chewing it over and over again. Can't let it go by and just drop it, you know? And it goes on and on and on. Yes, I mean, these debates over internet, highly contaminating. They're useless. It doesn't lead to anything, you know? Only to contamination. And you feel all really agitated and angry and upset and disturbed and, you know, and sometimes it can even take days to shake it off and kick it out of your head and let go of it. So as devotees, we should not engage in these kind of useless ego battles, you know, over the internet. It's terrible. So, you know, it's such a waste of time and highly contaminating. So better just to pull out Hare Krishna, okay, and close it. Don't be part of it. Don't be part of it. So contaminating. And there is also Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the book Bhaktyaloka. He talks about Prajalpa. And one, he lists a whole list of all kinds of forms of Prajalpa. And one of the kinds of Prajalpa is debating. Even though, of course, we know Mahaprabhu Namai Pandit, he was also debating and all this. But yeah, we as common devotees, this debating always means the matter is who is right and who is wrong. You know, it's actually an ego battle. Who knows better? You know, and this ego battle and wanting to defeat the other person, it's very much involving the false ego, and therefore not an uplifting and elevating way to discuss, you know. Inquiry should be in a humble state of mind and not in a provocative and challenging way. You know, even this provocative inquiry immediately, you know, ignites the ego, you know. And behind it is, actually, I know better. What do you know anyway? And blah, you know? So yeah, so that kind of inquiry in itself is already contaminating the whole atmosphere. You know, I'm sure every speaker has had that situation sometime, you know, that inquiry is made in a provocative and challenging mood. It has a contaminating effect, you know, and especially if the speaker also gets caught on the false ego platform and answers in a false ego way, and then everything is lost and spoiled and ugly and blah, 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 you know. Yeah, so whole big thing, you know. I mean, let us say a couple more things in regards to not defending before I open up for questions. One topic which sometimes comes up in this regard is about abuse in an abusive situation. So of course that's an exceptional situation. I'm not including that in this discussion that a devotee should not defend, you know? If a devotee finds him or herself in an abusive situation, so then of course the person has to speak up and share their minds with somebody confidential, and then better also another person defends, you know? Yes. So we are not saying that here now, that, you know, because especially in America, so many people come from abusive backgrounds, either in previous family or devotee situation or whatever. So yeah, we exclude definitely that situation. And also, there is some little permission for defending, and this is when one of the six aggressors attacks. What are they? Six aggressors. One who sets fire. Huh?
Sharpened weapons.
Attacking with sharp weapons? You're saying yes. And?
Stealing the wife.
Poisoning.
Steals wealth.
And occupies property. So, yes. So when one of these six aggressors attack, then we also are allowed to defend. But that doesn't happen every day, right? No, it doesn't. It's a very exceptional situation. Maybe the wife stealing is pretty common these days, but just as a little joke. But no, I mean, this is a very exceptional thing, you know? This doesn't happen every day. But nevertheless, we are defending every day. If we are a little more, you know, perceptive and reflecting and observing ourselves, we will discover that every day so many situations are there where we do defend. Yes, it's going on massively, and we don't even realize. Yes, and that leads us to the topic of tolerance. That tolerance is actually such an important quality to develop in spiritual practice. Tolerance is like one of the main criteria to measure a devotee's spiritual strength and advancement, and how tolerant that person can be. Right? Because tolerance means the ego is subdued, the ego is, on the way to be dissolved, because what stops us from tolerating is the false ego rebelling and protesting. So a person who can tolerate, it means the false ego is already, you know, a fair bit dissolved and subdued. So that's a sign of advancement. That's a sign of advancement. So, I mean, I have some quotes there, but, you know, since we don't have so much time, it's already 8 o'clock, I think we'll just skip them And you can always look up personally if you want to read some nice quotes about the importance of tolerance or something. But we'll just touch only briefly on it. But it's just interesting to understand how tolerance in material life is seen to be a weakness. Yes. That's how different, how opposite material life, spiritual life are. You know, what is victorious in success in spiritual life is being a loser in material life. So in spiritual life, it's glorious to be tolerant, but in material life, what? How can you tolerate that? You know, I'm not going to tolerate that nonsense. I'm walking out. I get divorced. I don't want to put up with all that. You know, that's to be seen as success, not to tolerate. You know, to stand up for yourself and fight for yourself. That's success in material life. Whereas in spiritual life, you know, it is opposite. To tolerate is success. I mean, it's so 180 degrees opposite. You know? That's why Krishna says 269, what is day to the materialist is night to the introspective sage. You know? So this whole topic of tolerance is quite a deep and important topic. Actually, that topic, I'm just thinking, in the Red Book, I'm talking about that quite in detail in the chapter of chastity, that a wife or woman can only be chaste if she's tolerant. And tolerance and shyness are the two main tools to cultivate chastity. Huh? Shyness. Yes. So in that chapter, I'm going quite through a whole discussion about tolerance, you know, to illustrate how important this quality is, actually. Yes. And yeah, I mean, we are just so conditioned by all this materialistic propaganda, you know, because it's so subtle and so strong, and we're all heavily surrounded by it, especially here in America, you know. But in Germany, not much less, you know, same thing. But yeah, and very easily we take these things into our spiritual practice. You know, we think we have our own opinions or something, but no, we are just a product of our surroundings. Because it's so subtle, it creeps in, you know. Yeah, so this whole thing of tolerance, you know, being a weakness, it is also entering our spiritual practice and our ISKCON society. I come across it quite a lot. You know, that, there is these misunderstandings there that we don't realize, you know, how important this quality of tolerance is. And one last thing I want to make before I ask for questions. Very often the point comes up in the discussion that people say, well, but how much can you tolerate? And people say, if I tolerate, then all this negativity builds up and it builds up and builds up and then I get all sick because of all this negative emotion, and then sooner or later I explode. So what's the answer to that? Is that tolerance? No, it's not. That's not tolerance. True tolerance means, you know, that we let go of it, the thing, whatever it may be, the whole situation. We let it go. We let it go by. We let it pass by. But when this negativity builds up, we internally we hang on to the whole ego battle internally. Right? We just put the cork on the bottle, you know, we suppress it. But internally it continues that we want justice and fairness, and we think, oh, it actually was not my fault, and blah, 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 You know, it keeps going on there internally. So that's not tolerance. That's not tolerance. Tolerance means, you know, first of all, tolerance. I mentioned it, I think, the other day in the Bhagavatam class. Tolerance, we need faith in Krishna. Without faith in Krishna, we cannot even develop tolerance because we cannot see Krishna's hand in things. We cannot connect our situation with Krishna arranging things, you know? So if we cannot see Krishna in the picture, we cannot tolerate. Only when we can connect things with Krishna being in the picture, then we can ask ourselves, okay, why is Krishna putting me in this situation? There must be some reason. What is he trying to teach me? There must be something I'm meant to learn here. Without that vision, we cannot tolerate. Impossible. So the two tools to tolerate is, for once, humility. There has to be some humility there. Proud person will never tolerate. Proud person will always rebel and answer back and blah, you know. So humility has to be there, and faith in Krishna. Without faith in Krishna, no chance to tolerate. And only if we have that faith in Krishna and we can connect things with Krishna being there and having his hand in the whole arrangement, obviously, you know, then that empowers us to truly let go, to truly say, okay, well, there must be some reason why Krishna is putting me in this situation. That attitude empowers us to truly tolerate and actually let go of this internal ego battle continuing. Yeah? Yeah, you understand my point? So if, you know, if we feel this negativity, you know, continuing and building up in us and boiling over there, then we have to clearly understand we are not tolerating. Yes. So we have to get on deeper levels of understanding what it actually means to tolerate. Right? Okay, so let me see whether we have any questions now. Yes, for the most part. Do we have a mic for, in case there is some online audience that they also hear the question?
Hare Krishna, thank you. It seems like tolerance, like anything, could be.
Can we make his mic a little louder?
Could be in the modes of nature. And then with the more realization and humility, it would be in mode of goodness and be more genuine and transcendental.
Be more?
Be more genuine and spiritual.
Yeah, I mean, the modes always play in, you know, so obviously the whole ego stuff is passion and ignorance, you know?
One quick question about the relationship between husband and wife. With the Vedic or ideal conception, I can understand the purification the wife must go through, but I don't see what the benefit for the husband. Because his ego would just be fed.
What?
His ego would just be fed.
As we said yesterday, the male ego will get dissolved by cooperating with other men. It's not us women's position, you know, to smash the men's egos. No. That happens amongst the men. Yeah, yes. No, I mean, I get in all details in the red book about this. You know, how we women are meant to be the power of inspiration and the auspicious source of energy and. So it might externally look like this, that, oh, that the wife just feeds the husband's egos. And sometimes women say this to me when they come and ask for advice or something, you know, that they say, yeah, well, but doesn't that just blow up my Ford, his Ford's ego, you know? That's none of our business. None of our business. Krishna will take care of that. There's plenty of opportunities for, amongst the men, you know, in cooperation, either within a community or in the material world. He has to battle it out and work there and this and that. So that's not the job of the wife, to worry about his false ego and, you know, giving him a bit of beating there or something. And I mean, for the husband also, there is so much tolerance he develops too within married life, you know, to deal with a woman's mind and emotions and the screaming kids and oh yes, I mean, yeah, you know, it's not only the wife getting that purification, the husband also. But the etiquette is there, how she is meant to treat him. But to be really honest, I don't want to get too much into that now. Because, yeah, I mean, not that I'm afraid of the discussion, but it's just going to... I have other courses about this. In the man, in this man-woman... I mean, actually, when I was offering the course, or I was in Mayapur, I used to call it Man and Woman in Spiritual Culture. But then I changed the title because often people were thinking this is all about married life. But no, it's so much more than that. It's you know, a whole human society. So if you read this book, you will find a lot of answers which are applicable to married life, but also to the general dealings between man and woman. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sankalpa Mataji, you had your hand up? Okay, sorry.
So when I think about the relationship between husband and wife, the idea of just that he's always right, it doesn't seem like a mature relationship because, you know, the wife, and I think the husband appreciates when you have a mature discussion about different points. It's not like, I'm right, you're right.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
You know,
yes.
Intelligent enough, mature enough, be able to have a reasonable discussion. I don't think that hurts the man. In fact, I think men appreciate to have like a reasonable discussion with their wife. Because what you see sometimes in India, that's very, for me, very disturbing. I mean, if you want to go to the extreme with what I'm talking about is, you know, the whole dowry idea and how women in India are often abused. I mean, speak about abuse.
Yeah,
the abuse in India is really off the charts.
Yes.
And I feel like a lot of that is this whole mentality that, yeah, you know, we're better. We're better than you. So, you know, get out of my way. I mean, that's not seeing everyone as a spirit soul. Like, you know, the man is a spirit soul, the woman is a spirit soul. I agree that respect has to be there, the humility has to be there. But ultimately, we have to see each other as spirit souls, too, not as, like, superior, inferior.
Yeah. See, I'm discussing it in detail in the book. Definitely, yeah, we all spirit souls, but we drive a certain vehicle. You know, we are driving a certain vehicle. And man's vehicle, woman's vehicle has very different natures. I mean, Prabhupada says it. You, when you read,
Of course they do, but still, that doesn't preclude the idea of having a relationship that where you can speak to each other.
Of course.
Just, okay, you said that, you're right.
Of course.
I mean, sometimes it's like it's good to say, well, did you say it in a nice way.
It depends. That's the whole thing.
Right.
Actually, all it takes is this, that we sacrifice this ego satisfaction. That's all it takes of not wanting to show that I'm no better. You know? Yes.
It's just trying to work together.
Yes.
For the best outcome.
Yes.
I mean, that's really what we're looking for.
And a wife, a clever wife, will learn the tactic to deal with the male ego, make it her best friend rather than her enemy. You know, like for example, in Bangalore, there's one family who I usually stay with when I give some seminars there. So the husband was saying to me once, "Of course, my wife is my better half. Of course, I will ask her for her opinions before I make a decision. Of course, she's serving me so in such a dedicated way. Of course, I'm going to ask her. I would never ever decide anything without hearing her opinion." So then she told me, whenever my husband asks me for my opinion, then I tell him, "Yeah, well, if you ask me, I would like to have it like this and this and this. But whatever you decide is fine with me." She hands it back to him. She lets him make the decision. So, you know, that's one way which is very helpful if we want to have harmonious relationships with men around us, that we try and make them understand that my idea is his idea. And all it takes is just the you know, that we're sacrificing this ego satisfaction of saying, "By the way, it was my idea, remember?" You know? That's all it takes. You know? That we just humbly give the idea, but we let him decide. Yes. And if a woman treats like that the husband, then he will actually be a better caregiver and taking charge. He will be empowered to be responsible. You know? But really, I don't want to get into this topic because I want to share something else. And we have only 15 minutes left, so yeah, I don't, yeah, if you don't mind. Did you have a question or comment? Yeah, see, I wanted to share these 6 points, these 6 steps, yes, for this internal work, yes, and I'm just afraid it will get too late, you know. So, yes, maybe I shouldn't have brought up this husband and wife topic, you know, maybe that was my mistake that I put that a little bit on the table, you know. But I mean, it says in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, that by the husband's constitutional position, he wants to be superior, and the wife has to accept it, even if there's a wrong on the husband. Prabhupada says it, you know, and I'm sorry, I have that unflinching faith in Prabhupada's words, you know, that he says it for a reason, you know. So, but I mean, I completely understand your point. Of course, it doesn't mean, you know, that, "Oh, the wife just has to shut up and not say anything." No, of course not. My God, you know. Let's get away from these shallow cliche type of understandings, you know. So of course not like that. But I remember in my own marriage how sometimes I just couldn't be quiet. I had to have the last word, and drove my husband, made him furious, you know, because I just couldn't stop. I mean, we women are pretty expert in carrying on and on and on and blah, 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 you know, and then, boo, the husband's fuse blows, you know. I mean, I remember from my married life a few incidences like that, where I was definitely the one who drove the poor man nuts, you know, by just not being able to let it go and just be quiet, you know. Yeah, so that's more what I meant, you know. But it doesn't mean that she can't say anything, and of course not, my God, definitely not. That's not what I was meant to say. So do we have any other questions just about what we talked? And if you don't mind, not so much about the husband and wife relationship now, because I don't want to get stuck on this. Yes. Yes, if there's another question before I give these 6 points.
Okay, you said, from what I understand, you said,
like you gave the experience of yourself honoring your mother's superior position.
Yes, yes.
And, but then on the other hand, you say that when a young boy, our son, turns 16,
yes,
you begin to deal with him in a different way, as if to make him feel like he's your hero also, like you,
yes,
you know.
Yes, yes, so because it's built into the male.
Some, that seems to be somewhat, how do you resolve that, where he should be honoring the mother superior, what, you know, get it?
Yes.
So how do we start feeding that male ego or whatever, or supporting them?
But see, actually, there is no problem at all if both follow the etiquettes. If he has, you know, that attitude that, yes, my mother is superior, and she has the attitude, yes, my son, he is a grown-up man now, and he is the hero. You know, so then there will be no problem whatsoever. You know? Right? If both sides follow the etiquettes, then it will be very nice. Right? What are you laughing? Okay. So, since we have only 10 more minutes left, let me quickly present these 6 very practical points. Let us imagine, you know, we find ourselves, you know, we discover that we often defend. Doesn't matter in which relationship it is, whether it's husband and wife or whatever, you know, no need to just think now only husband and wife. Any situation where we easily always defend, we blame others, we find excuses, and. So how to go about it to actually transform these ego patterns of behaviors? And these 6 steps, they're actually very practical for any kind of transformational work we want to do. Even in case when we discover that we are envious, you know, and we, in envy, we are acting, you know, in an inappropriate way. So let me quickly present. First step is always hearing about the topic. That's why we are having this whole discussion here on the false ego, that we hear how the ego affects us, how it's getting into our way, and how subtle it is, and. Or envy also, in the blue book I have a whole chapter on envy, how envy comes out towards seniors, equals, and inferiors, you know. So first we have to hear. That wakes us up from our unconsciousness and makes us more aware and mindful. So, and after hearing, there should be desiring, right? So if we hear long enough how this ego is spoiling our whole spiritual development and advancement, so then we should come to this point of desiring. I have to do something about this. I have to transform these ego patterns of behavior into humble servant patterns of behaviors. So, and then third step is introspection in honesty. We have to honestly introspect. We have to look within ourselves. What am I saying here? Why am I saying this? Why am I doing this? Am I a humble servant, or am I trying to establish that I know better and I'm superior? So without introspection and honesty, no chance. No chance. And as we said, we might need a bit of help from a mentor, because we might just not notice it even if we try to be honest and introspective, but we might not be able to see it. So introspection and honesty, absolutely necessary. I mean, without introspection and honesty, we cannot uproot all these, you know, these, yes, all these almost demoniac qualities we are carrying, actually, you know. So introspection and honesty. Then, 4th step, we catch ourselves doing the wrong thing. That's already progress. Because before, we didn't even realize it was wrong. You know? But now, we catch ourselves doing the wrong thing that we, again, I was trying to establish my superior position and answering back and showing that, I'm right and I'm better. You know? So we catch ourselves doing the wrong thing. That's already a tiny little progress, actually, as a result of that introspection and honesty. So, and then, let me ask you now, what's the fifth step after catching ourselves doing the wrong thing? What's the next step?
Apologize?
Yes, regret, lamentation, crying out to Krishna. Actually, without Krishna's help, we cannot uproot these things. You know, false ego is so deep, so subtle. We've been carrying it with us for so many lifetimes. We, out of our own strength, we can't even free ourselves from it. You know, that's why I was saying before, it's not enough to just make a resolution, okay, I'm just not going to do this anymore. No. Because the ego is so strong and pushing, wants that gratification of being superior and being right. It's so subtle, so strong, we can't even control it. So our only saving grace is to cry out to Krishna, please Krishna, remove this Hiranyakashipu there in my heart. Nrisingadev, come with your sharp nails. You know? Yeah, we have to lament and cry out to Krishna. But our problem is that we always think this ego gratification also gives us some enjoyment. You know, and that's why we hang on to it, actually. We have this hope that it will give us some juicy fruit, some nectar there of being superior, you know? And that's why we usually hang on to it. We don't really sincerely beg Krishna to perform that heart surgery. So lamenting, crying out to Krishna. And then when we do these last three things, introspection and honesty, catching ourselves doing the wrong thing, crying out to Krishna and lamenting. If we work on these last three things, introspection and honesty, catching ourselves doing the wrong thing, lamenting and crying out to Krishna, sooner or later we come to step number six where we catch ourselves doing the right thing. Yes. It really works. I mean, I speak from my own experience. I've worked out these steps and I'm applying them and it works. It works. And sooner or later, you come to a situation where you think, wow, you know, a few months before, I would have reacted differently. I would have gone for it. I would have, you know, answered back and engaged in the whole ego battle. But now I could just let it go by and not take the bait. You know, that Maya throws in front of us here, but we just let it go by, okay. Leaves me cool, no problem. I don't have to answer back and, you know. So, and if we do this internal work, introspection and honesty, catching ourselves doing the wrong thing, lamenting and crying out to Krishna, that's actually when we agree to get some purification. When we do this internal work, you know, that's when we actually make progress. You know, often we have very external understanding what it means to make progress in devotional service. We think it's just a question of getting up there on the ladder of hierarchy, or becoming a more and more prominent person, and. But no, that's when we actually make progress, when we do this internal work. You know, of introspection and honesty, catching ourselves doing the wrong thing and crying out to Krishna. Yes. And these, you know, these steps we can, as I said, we can easily apply them for any kind of internal work where we want to change, you know, and let go of some unwanted behaviors and others, you know. Yes. Okay, so conclusive question. Yes.
So we stop the outward manifestation of our ego. Our ego getting in the way of Krishna. And so what if we're still, okay, we stopped doing the outward manifestation of it, but we still have this internal dialogue with these bad habits still going on. So how do we know that we're actually making progress? I mean, how can we gauge that? Is it anyway?
Well, basically, you know, tonight we discussed this one aspect of Vaishnava etiquette, that we follow the Vaishnava etiquette of not defending and not protecting the ego. So, in parallel, we mentioned yesterday that we chant Hare Krishna, we chant the holy name, longing to serve, that purifies, and then this internal work. So when we catch ourselves that we are still locked up in this internal battles and. So, you know, by hearing and understanding how the ego affects us, then hopefully that will strengthen the spiritual intelligence, that we can make the diagnosis. We realize, hang on, this is just the ego thing, you know, I'm caught up in this ego thing, I can't let go, and, you know. So that means we're catching ourselves doing the wrong thing. And then we cry out to Krishna, we lament, please Krishna, help me, let me give up my ego, let me dissolve these patterns of behaviors, and. So these steps, I don't have any other recommendation. And then if we have a mentor can help us to assess ourselves, you know, to give us feedback, you know? Yes. Was there any other question? I mean, usually I like to finish by actually this little personal exercise that you turn to your neighbor and share what are you taking out of here after the session. You want to do this quickly, just for 1 minute? Yeah, I'm just worried that you will all get up and leave while we are asking the last question. Do we want to take a last question, or do we want to do the exercise and share what we're taking out? It's a comment. It's a quick one. Okay.
The verse 7, chapter Bhagavad Gita 26. Krishna says, I know the past, present, future. So I was writing a little article, says, because the devotee asked me a question, so that whatever circumstances we are seeing the presence and planning for future. But in this verse, Krishna says, he sees the future for Pran Govinda Das and he's planning for my presence. So our calculation method is two-way. Therefore, it is better to depend on Krishna. And even though it doesn't make sense according to my calculation, my plan, but have a faith, as you said, and depend on Krishna, because Krishna sees the future and planning my presence. But I'm seeing only my presence, planning for future. It will never match most of the time. But have a trust and keep going.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, let's quickly turn to our neighbor and share. What are we taking out of this session? What's the realization of this evening? Just 2 minutes. Quickly share with each other. Pai Guru Premanandi, Hari Hari Om. So tomorrow we meet at Mother Ekadashi Vata's house at 6, right? 6 p.m. There will be some prasad, and then 6:30 sharp we start with the seminar. I don't know the location, Ekadashi Vrata Mataji's house. It's announced on the newsletter. 12930 Northwest 151st Road. My God, what complicated. In the Alachua Forest. Okay, we'll go to the forest tomorrow. Okay, so please come to the last session tomorrow. We will discuss tomorrow some more rules of Vaishnava etiquette, which are very important in order to help us dissolve our ego. So there is so much more to come. So please come tomorrow. And tomorrow will also be your last chance to get some books if you haven't gotten any yet, because day after tomorrow I will be leaving. Okay, thank you very much, everybody. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveda Bhaktivinoda ki, Guru Premanandi, Hare Krishna.